Hi, it's Colleen O'Brien for Sharp Vision Modern LASIK. I can't believe I waited so long to have LASIK. 2018 is your year for LASIK. Don't wait another year. For a limited time, receive $1,000 off your LASIK procedure. Go online to schedule your free consultation.
This is Seattle's Morning News. We've talked a lot about the sheer number of people imprisoned in America. We still lead the world in that department. And among other things, it makes it pretty much impossible for people to get jobs. It, of course, breaks up families. Sometimes it's for the kind of drug violation that's completely legal now. Andre Norman talks about this. He's had some firsthand experience, was talking with the kids at Roosevelt High School here in Seattle. And would you consider yourself to be a motivational speaker? What's the message you give to kids when you talk to them?
When I speak to kids, I'm considered a motivational speaker. That's the easiest term to understand. I talk to kids about doing better and being better, wanting to achieve higher statuses in life. If that yesterday at Roosevelt is about inclusion, so the kids were having situations and questions around how do we include all genders, all races, all ethnicities into the school and make everybody feel comfortable. So I wanted to help them figure that process out.
Give us the 50 Cent tour of your own life, Andre.
The 50 Cent tour of my own life. Grew up in inner city. Mom went through the domestic violence scenarios, went through the busing crisis where kids would throw
where
rocks.
Where was this?
In Boston. Yeah. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. Kids used to throw rocks at us and call us because they had the integration of schools, illiterate to the third grade until a teacher intervened. No dad, single mom, six kids. I drift. I'm second youngest. I put down my dream of playing the trumpet, and I have no dream. Once I had no dream, it was all over. So 14 without a dad is bad, 14 and poor is bad, 14 and no dream is impossible.
What happened?
You go to jail.
Well, you know, they don't just go around jail, arresting you people.
No, I mean, you drop out of school. Yeah. There's no one really there to keep you guided and focused. So I joined a gang, I run the street, and either you die or you go to jail. And I went to prison.
What was that like?
Prison is a huge reunion for the people from the dummy classes, from the people from the principal's office, from the people used to fight against downtown and after the movie theater. It's a giant reunion of people who are just unwanted and have no dreams.
Was there any rehab going on there?
No, more reunion and rehab.
So what did you learn? What
did I learn in prison? That it's a giant waste of time. It's just a dumping ground for people with no self-control. If you don't have self-control, the country will take control of you and drop you here.
Funny you should say that, because years ago I went to a graduating class for a prison course, and the reporters were seated next to the inmates, and we just struck up conversations. And one guy turned to me and said, "You know, I'm no different from you, except I just can't control. I have the same thoughts as you do, but I can't control my impulse to act on them."
Yeah.
And which was a sobering thought, I suppose. So obviously, you got out of it. How?
At some point, everybody has a day where the epiphany kicks in that this life is not what I want. This is the world that I haven't chosen. There's no glory in being in prison. You don't get, like, stickers and banners and parades. And you wake up one day, and you just say, I don't want to do this anymore. Huh. For me, I happen to be in segregation. I happen to be a gang leader. I happen to be a boss. So when I made that decision, I was in a different situation than most people. You're just a regular guy in jail or a gang member, and you have that epiphany. Now you have to fight against everything around you that you don't have control over. When I made the decision, I had leverage based on my history in prison that people allowed me, based on my being kind of crazy, to go ahead and make that move.
Huh. So, well, then prison did kind of work because it made you decide, I don't want to do this anymore.
Prison didn't make me decide. I just came to a point. I needed prison because I was out of control. If you'd have left me in society and just didn't lock me up, I'd have kept catching cases and kept getting in trouble. I needed at one level to be sat down and why I had to just come to a place to deal with myself. Prison will give you the opportunity to deal with yourself. And that's what I needed, a place where I could deal with myself, get help for the issues that were bothering me, and help to work on those.
So when you got out, that first day you left prison, where did you go? Who helped you?
I had a rabbi, Natan Schaefer, who was at the prison, who befriended me and mentored me for like the last 2 years of my sentence. I had two nuns from the Catholic Church who befriended me and mentored me for like the last year and a half of my sentence. Then we had a volunteer, a guy named Pat Dempsey, just an old regular guy, white guy from the suburbs who was a prison volunteer. he'd come up to one of the youth programs, and he became, like, my best friend. And he eventually became the best man at my wedding.
Really?
Yes.
Just a stranger?
For me, stranger, yeah. Just a strange white guy, volunteered to prison.
Would you guys talk about that? You know, what did the mentoring involve? How did you relate to this guy?
The relation isn't about being white or being black. He saw that I had potential, I had gifts, and I wanted to do something. Like most teachers, which is what he was, he loves a great student. And I represented a great student, somebody who wanted to advance my life and do something, and he wanted to facilitate that.
Huh. So once you got out, what kind of skills did you have? How'd you get a job?
When I got out, the skill that I had, I didn't understand my skills. See, I had the ability to manipulate. I had the ability to convince people. I had the ability of patience. I had the ability to have exercise vision and discipline and follow through. These are the things that we learned in jail. I had the ability to be loyal. I do corporate trainings based on gang loyalties now.
What?
Corporate retention. Every major corporation loses its staff daily. It's senior management. I've been in a gang, and I've never had a gang member quit my gang, join the other gang, and shoot back at me. Happens every day in corporate America. They said, Andre, can you teach our people that type of loyalty? Can you teach our people to have that type of vision of wanting to do something and doing it under those circumstances?
What do gangs have in common with corporations?
Gangs have in common with corporations, it's really the opposite. When a corporation, they hire you, they train you, they get you to the senior level management, and then you get offered something across the street, you quit your job, and you go across the street, and you take all your secrets with you. Mm-hmm. We don't do that.
The gangs don't do that.
The gangs don't do that. You don't. We've had.
Well, that's because if they did do that, you'd get shot, right?
For sure.
Okay.
So, but the baseline is, we can go out tomorrow, take a corner over, sell drugs on that corner. Somebody can come by, a rival gang, and shoot us. And somebody will die on that corner. We'll show up tomorrow for work. Somebody dying on our corner doesn't prevent work. So people don't generally turn on the gang. They don't give up on the gang. They don't give up on the culture or the lifestyle. So that level of loyalty and commitment is what we teach to corporate America.
Huh. So what's the secret to that then? I mean, that'll cost you.
So that's.
But I assume it does not involve packing a gun with you into the corporate
suite. No guns. It's all psychological. What did we teach people to make them show up to work and stand on a debt on where their brother died the day before? What did we teach people to make them want to go to jail for 20, 30 years? What do we teach people to make them, against all odds, stay loyal? And the corporations wanted to know that.
Mm. So for, I assume it would be better, of course, if a kid didn't have to go through what you went through before coming to that epiphany. So what's the key to that?
The key to, I get asked, what would you say to a 15-year-old version of yourself? My dream was to go to Harvard University. My dream was to be successful. My dream was to make an impact in the world. And I can, at one level, say I'm doing that. I've worked at London Business School. I've worked at Harvard Law School. I've worked all over the globe. I've taught at the best universities. I've worked every place you can think of that would make me say, hey, I made it. What I would say to a 15-year-old Andre, or a 15-year-old Chico, or a 15-year-old Rick, is don't speak to their potential. I didn't become smart in prison. I was gifted as 12. I was gifted at 10. Everybody spoke to my potential. Nobody wanted to speak to my pain. My pain is what was blocking my future.
Mm-hmm.
Your potential doesn't block your future. It's your pain that blocks your future.
So what does that look like? I mean, if a teacher listening right now says, okay, there's a nugget there, but how do I use that in the classroom?
For a teacher, I would say, and we love teachers, by the way. Shout out to all teachers in the U.S. and around the world. Teachers saved my life. But for a teacher who has a gifted child in their class, but he's just going down the wrong road, don't focus on his potential. Find out what's hurting him. Because if you can find out maybe his mother's being abused, maybe his sister's being abused, maybe he's hurt because he doesn't have his dad in his life, whatever his issue is that's causing the hurt, the trauma, try to address that. Because if you remove the trauma from his life or her life, then his potential can take over.
So you got to go deep. You can't just...
You can't go surf.
Based
it's
on,
tough.
What,
it's
on
tough
what's
work.
In the classroom, you got to get to know the family.
Most teachers aren't therapists. So you have to kind of bring in the counselor. Now, when there's a mass shooting, what's the first thing they do at a school?
Bring in
at
the
a
counselors.
White school, bring in a counselor.
Yeah.
At Roosevelt High School, unfortunately, a teacher passed. And we want to give a shout out to Roosevelt's teacher staff. First thing they did was bring in grief counselors. There's no grief counselors in the hood.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not justifying anything, but white schools understand when there's a traumatic experience, you need trauma relief. There's no trauma relief in the inner cities. There's no trauma relief in the rural areas. So all your trauma beset, is going to come out some form of fashion.
Well, now, I mean, does that mean we ought to start opening psychologist offices in different neighborhoods?
If you did it for all of the suburban white schools, and there's a reason you do it.
Yeah.
Because you understand what trauma does.
Yeah.
So why would we not do it in the urban and the rural schools?
Yeah. Well, makes sense to me. So let's talk about some other issues that surround us. One of the proposed solutions to address the problem that that former prisoners have is this block-the-box idea, where employers would not be allowed to know, at least initially, when somebody's applying for a job, whether that applicant is a felon or not, as a way of giving them at least a chance to get a foot in the door. What do you think about that?
As a felon applying for a job, I love the concept because I want the job.
Yeah.
I am now a business owner, and I employ people sometimes. I want to know who I'm hiring. As an owner, I want to know who I'm hiring. And I believe I should have the right to know who I'm hiring. I want to help society. I want to be an open guy. I want to be open-minded. I want to be liberal. I want to be all those things. But this is my company. And if my company has 20 employees or 40 employees, and I want to hire this guy, and he turns out to be a bad seed, 70% of people, whatever the percentages are, I hire a guy because I can't check the box, or he can't check the box, and he's a bad. What does a bad day look like for him at my company? And what does my company do after he has a bad day? And can we take the bounce? Can we handle his fallout? Does that shut my company down? So when you start talking about jeopardizing the company's sustainability versus this guy's chance at a second chance, I would lean to say, hey, the company should be able to know and make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't want you here and I'm the boss, once I find out, you're fired anyways.
Yes,
but
you're not in favor.
I'm an open-minded guy.
You're not in favor of block the box, then.
I am not in favor of block the box.
But it sounds like, given your experience, if somebody checked that box, it wouldn't necessarily prevent you from hiring him.
No, it doesn't prevent me from hiring him. It creates a conversation because I want to put tools around this man or this woman so he can be supported in my company. I need to say to myself as a company owner, do we have the tools to support this person? There's a company down in Memphis called HopeWorks. They are designing support teams for companies to hire felons, but as a company, you get a life coach for those employees. So if they have a bad day or the supervisor's not sure how to approach them, there's somebody there to help them through the process, to mediate.
Is there a way to certify when somebody finally has achieved impulse control? Because that's the thing, right? You got to achieve impulse control. And apparently, you've gotten there. What would it take to convince you that this employee who had this problem in his past now has control of it?
Their actions. You can say anything you want out of your mouth. You're a radio guy. You can say anything. But it's not what you say, it's what you do. And if you can demonstrate through your actions, not your words, that you've changed and you deserve a chance, you should get it. I'm a firm believer, and I can attest, that corporate America, that corporate Europe, and that corporate every place will hire you if you can make them money. If you can make them money, they will hire you. They will overlook anything and everything that you've ever done if you can generate a check for them.
Yeah.
So if you can show your value, people will hire you, even with issues. I can pick the biggest star you want, an athlete. If he got caught smoking weed tonight or crack, he will still have a job tomorrow because he can generate income. Steve Howe, 7 times, had cocaine use. I feel for the brother. He got hired back 7 times, not because of any other reason that he could throw a ball. He could generate income. If you can generate income, that's what this is about, people will hire you.
So the box is not going to block you if you've got that kind of
value. If you have talent, you can find a job.
Okay. Now, let's talk about race relations. Are black people and white people ever going to understand each other?
We understand each other. We agree to disagree. Black people and white people can get along. And there are wonderful black people in the world. There are wonderful black people in the world. And there's just some on both sides who are stuck. I've done panels at Harvard Law School. I've done panels all over the country. And there are some people who come to the panels wanting to vent their pain. They want to come scream and yell. They don't want to come look for a solution. They just want to stay in the space of yelling. And some people want to come with a solution. So, sure, you can say, hey, slavery was horrible all day. Sure, killing of black men by police officers is horrible. We can go down the list of things, but we can keep articulating the problem, or we can sit down and try to come up with a solution. And for all the people who are just screaming about the problem, it's never going to get to a solution.
And so what is the problem?
And we, of what, blacks and white folks?
Yeah.
We have just an inherent scenario where we were held captive against our will. Slavery, which I tell people, was legal in so many countries for so many centuries. So the act of slavery, as horrible as it is, was a common practice around the world. So you actually can't be super upset at slavery because at one level, every group has been enslaved. The treatment that black folks received in this country while enslaved is what I have a problem with, because that was just above and beyond anything that should have and could have been. I mean, there are people who've had slaves and whatever that looked like.
Yeah.
The treatment and the torture had to endure by the slave is where the problem should be addressed, because that's the trauma. Those are the things that people are still acting out today. Those are the issues that are preventing people from getting their lives together. In India, in Africa, in Europe, all over the world, in China, they've always had slaves in this world. So it was just our turn, for lack of a better statement.
Right. So, but what do you do about that? I mean, the history can't be changed. It's there.
The history can't be changed.
So what do you do about that now?
We're going to go back to, let's look at what works in the white communities when there's trauma. Counseling. We don't get counseling. We need therapy. This is a professional issue. It needs professional counseling. So I don't.
What kind of history counseling?
You need trauma counseling. That's trauma.
Just trauma.
When your great-grandfather was tortured and raped and beat, and whatever lessons that he took out of life and that pain he passed down to his child, it's generational. It's like alcoholics. It passed it down. It's generational. So you've been tormented and tortured to an extent that you've passed it on. And that spirit
is passed on. Every black person needs counseling?
Not. Some people have found ways to deal with it, but it should be available for those who need it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying everybody is still living in that trauma, but for those who haven't been able to get over it, and there are some, they need additional counseling. When somebody dies at a school, there's grief counseling. Everybody doesn't need it. There are those kids who just can't handle that trauma and they break down more so than the other kids. And you focus on them. So we have 2 million people in jail. They could have used counseling.
So what stands in the way of that happening? I mean, anybody's hearing this now say, well, maybe I need counseling. I mean, you're free to go get counseling if you think you need it, right?
Free to go get counseling. And it's like people who are drinking. They're free to go to AA. But do they go?
Yeah.
Most drinkers don't just voluntarily put themselves in AA. The average drug abuser doesn't voluntarily go to NA. They just stay in their space until they crash and burn.
Then maybe a better question is to ask, so how would a black person know that they need counseling just about their own history?
I can tell you from day one they need it. And it would be a great
So everybody business. Needs it.
Yeah, every come on. I mean, I don't want to say.
I don't know. This is a whole new concept to me.
Therapy,
the idea that everyone needs counseling because of how they were historically treated. I mean, it's.
No, it's not just because you're historically treated. Some people don't handle it well.
Yeah.
Or haven't handled it well. There's some Seahawks fans who haven't gotten over the fact that they lost.
Yeah.
I live in Atlanta. There's some people down there who are still hurting. I mean, they get a. Yeah. I'm from New England, so I'm a Patriot fan. I say I'm from New England, people still boo me. I'm like, get over it. I mean, you made a bad call. We love Pete. We fired him. And y'all took him up, and he made a bad call. That's it. But there are some people who are still irate and hurt over that one.
Right. And they would never think of getting counseling for it.
They need it.
Yeah, but they need it.
They need it. It would help.
So that's what you're saying.
I believe professional counseling can help ease a lot of the ills between the people, because it's about mediation, coming to grips with yourself. Forgiveness is never about the other person. It's about you. Understanding your trauma is never about the other person. It's about you. I made a choice to be a criminal. I made a choice, and my choice was based on my trauma. When I got healed, I made a choice to be productive. I'm the same person. What's the difference between me now and me as a 15-year-old? I made a choice, and my choice is now based on having therapy, having counseling, and having proper support.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to rob somebody.
Some people would say that you really didn't have a choice because the neighborhood you grew up in and the circumstances that you encountered.
Anybody who says my neighborhood made me is dreaming. There are thousands, if not millions, of people who grew up in adverse situations that make it. Do not let people label the inner cities or the urban, whatever, the black sections of town, Hispanic sections of town, as, oh my God, you can't make it because you come from there. Thousands, if not millions, of people have come from the inner city and done extremely well. There are those of us who can't, who don't have those skills or that internal support, and we don't do well. It's not based on the neighborhood, even though it's not a great starting point. I mean, granted, I'd much rather live in like Savin Hills or some really nice place, but it's not just the neighborhood. Inside of those neighborhoods, now you have to look at the family structure. And the family structure, one mother has the ability to comport and engage your child, and one mother doesn't. They live side by side.
But I know I had it easier than you as a kid. I mean, I had to have it. I mean, I grew up in a neighborhood in Westchester County. We had a tennis court in the backyard. My only criminal choices were, you know, whose lawn to mow. I mean, that was...
Right. I mean, granted, when you don't have the support, then what around you becomes a possibility.
Yeah.
When I was playing the trumpet and I was focused, I didn't think about getting in trouble. When I lost my dream of playing the trumpet and being focused, then the other things became available. When I was in jail and getting in trouble and acting a fool and participating in gang activity, the schools were there. The counseling was there. When I made the choice to change my life, the school didn't appear the next day. It had been there from day one. I wasn't ready to access the help that was around me. Our public schools, as bad as they are, have thousands of teachers who love us.
So the help is there.
The help is there. We don't have the ability to access the help because we have blockage. Our pain is blocking the ability to reach out. I personally waited 26 years for my father to be my savior. I didn't want a school teacher. I didn't want an after-school basketball coach. I didn't want the chess club guy. I didn't want the leadership guy. I wanted my father to be the one to save me. And I refused help from everybody who wasn't him. And it wasn't until I accepted through my counseling he wasn't coming could I then accept somebody else.
Wow. So when you talk to the kids at Roosevelt, I mean, what you've basically told us here is that even though you think the cards are stacked against you, there's a way you can improve your hand just by deciding to.
There are thousands of white kids in this country who they like to use the word opioid, I call it heroin, who are hooked on heroin.
Yeah.
And they're dying. Right now, they come from great homes. Where you live, the tennis court, whose yacht I want to mow. They are getting high and dying daily. Why? If it's just about the neighborhood, if it's just about the school or the size of your house, yeah. Why are these kids getting hooked on heroin, getting hooked on painkillers or whatever else they're doing and dying? It's not about just where you live. Sometimes those options, when some options are available in the suburbs, guess what? Your kids are choosing them too.
Yeah.
And I had a discussion yesterday. What they need in the suburbs are black outreach workers. Not to be funny.
Right.
We've been dealing with substance abuse since the 50s.
That's right.
60s, 70s. Heroin, crack has been in our neighborhoods forever. So we've had people who've grown up learn how to deal with that at that level. In the suburbs, you're gonna send your white kids to the psychiatrist. He's gonna write another prescription, which is the problem. Because he wrote a prescription for mom. The kid stole that and did it. Now you're writing a prescription for the kid. They're gonna do that too. In our areas, in our neighborhoods, we've had people from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s who lived through all this horrendous stuff, and we've developed a core group of people who are experts at dealing with street-level substance abuse. You don't have that in the suburbs. You need that. But are the suburban whites going to call us to say, you know something, we need your help?
Yeah. So when you go to school like Roosevelt and you give this talk, does the light go on? Do you see people come up to you and say, wow, I didn't know that?
When I talk to the kids at the school, it's not about my history or my personal view on life. I speak to them about where they are and what they can do. So at Roosevelt, the first thing we worked on was gratitude. We had all the kids stand up, come down out of the stands. I'm talking about 1,200 kids. This wasn't like five kids. We had all the teachers line up, and I told the kids, These people are your foundation. They're here to educate you to have great lives. And you need to come down and thank them for that. So all the kids came out of the stands. They hugged their teachers, kissed their teachers, shook their hands, and sat down. I said, that is the foundation of getting to inclusion. Step one, gratitude. Be thankful for what you have. Because if you can't show gratitude towards a teacher, you never show kindness to a stranger or someone that doesn't look like you. So let's get the baseline covered. Respect your teachers. Now let's talk about respecting each other. And oftentimes we skip over the baseline and just try to get to what we think is the first issue. And it's not. First issue is respecting teachers. Second issue is us respecting each other.
Hmm. Turnaround stories. Kids you met and you mentored.
I've met turnaround stories. There was a scenario in Ferguson, Missouri. A gentleman named Michael Brown Jr. was shot and killed.
Yeah.
There's debate about who's right, who's wrong, but the after effect was rioting, was protesting, was city burning, was CNN and every other news camera showing up. And when I was called, after probably a while, I showed up and I went to Ferguson. And when I went to Ferguson, I didn't go to Ferguson at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with a news camera and some bodyguards trying to take a photo op. I went to Ferguson at 2 o'clock in the morning when the protesters were getting together to decide where they were going to go to protest and get water hose or tear gassed again. And I spoke to them. I said, what's going on? How are you feeling? Why are you out here? What does it take to end this? And most of them were so angry at just fed up at being fed up. They didn't know what they really wanted or when looked like. They just felt like we got to do something. So as a result, I worked with a team of people and we took a group from Ferguson, protest leaders. We took a group, mayor, the police chief of Ferguson, Dave Spence, who ran for governor. We had an economist and we brought them all to Harvard Law School. And we had the protesters and we had the city government and the people who cared all on one panel, and it went crazy. It was just because some people came, the people we invited came to discuss solutions. The outside folks forced in some venters. They didn't want a solution. They just wanted to scream about their pain, which derailed the conference. But what happened is we all stayed in the same hotel. So the police chief and the protesters had a chance to talk. Dave Spence, gubernatorial candidate, and the protesters had a chance to talk. And at dinner, we had dialogue. And it was like, okay, I'm going to respect you as a man. We can agree to disagree civilly. And when they went back to Ferguson, now the police chief knows the lead protester. The mayor knows the lead protester. And it helped eliminate the need to actually shoot fire hoses and tear gas. And it diminished that. And that same guy, Bruce Franks, went from being a street protester slash entrepreneur to a state rep.
Wow.
He's now in Jeff City trying to change the law that gives sanctions to killing of black people. See, it's not the cop who does it, because if you don't change the law, I don't care how much you protest or scream or people say you shoulda, coulda, woulda, police are killing people at one level based on what the law says is applicable. If I'm in fear of my life, when I engage you, right, I can kill you.
Right.
Now, we had a scenario in Boston where the cop jumped on top of a car. A car was trying to speed away. The cop jumped on the car. Then he shot him through the sunroof. Well, at the time he shot him, he could say he was in fear. Now, what he was doing on top of the car is a whole other story. To Mayor Rice, when I saw that case, I knew in my heart it was going to be no process. The cop can say, when I shot him, I saw a gun. I was in fear of my life. Why you put up 2 feet from him? Why you disregarded every radio broadcast that came across your car? That's not in the room. The question is asked, when you shot, were you in fear?
Right.
That's the law we have to change. We have to add some sensibility in there. You shouldn't pull up 2 feet from someone that you was told had a gun, play gun or not. You had plenty of space. You could have pulled up 3 yards, 10 yards, 30 yards away, pull out your bullhorn. But they pulled 2 feet away, and within the law, they pulled that trigger.
Okay, so tell me this. What do you do about the people in this country who were so concerned about the cultural changes in America and the perception that every minority is getting rights that they don't get, that they put Donald Trump in office?
Donald Trump. Donald Trump. Hey, we have a system that you vote. And I can say this. Donald Trump was elected based on his campaign. I mean, if you can market, you can win. And he had a better marketing campaign than the Democrats. And we can like it or not like it. We can like him or not like him. He had a better marketing campaign than the Democrats. And that's what it comes down to. Can you reach your base? Can you reach your constituents? And how you reach them, we might not agree with. We might think some of the things he said were completely out of line. But he's speaking to his base. And there's enough people who think, like Donald, that he is now president. And we can not like it. we can like it. But the baseline is if he can reach out to those people again, then, hey, there's some people out there that need counseling. Because if you follow some of the stuff that he said and you thought that was cool, then you need – there's a historical invite for people who need
counseling. Do you think the country's hopelessly divided now?
Hopelessly divided, no. The good thing about Donald Trump – I'm in Seattle. I hope not to get mugged when I leave here. No, the good thing about Donald Trump being president, if amongst other things, our system is working, you can elect who you want. The good thing about Donald Trump being president, the entire country is involved in the political system. There was a time when Barack was elected, black folks went home and went to sleep. They chilled out. The liberals went home and just kicked their feet up. And the Republicans got up at arms, but the Democrats sat back. And when Bush was elected and that whole team, then the Democrats came to life and the Republicans kicked back. President Donald Trump has invigorated the entire country to be political. We've never had this much political involvement that I can remember in my lifetime. So he has everybody, white, black, poor, rich, from the country, whatever side you're on, you're involved. I travel the world. In Sweden, everybody's political. In France, everybody's political. Everywhere you go, 12-year-old kids understand politics. We don't. We just let people do it for us. Donald Trump has created a space where everybody is now involved and paying attention.
So I guess we should ask people to rush down for the bleachers and embrace and thank Donald Trump for having taught us this lesson.
That's how it works. I mean, we had issues with Bush. There's some people who had issues with Obama. There's always going to be issues. But if you go back and look, it's usually the opposition that flares up when the other team is in office. Right now, you have the Republicans flared up. You have the Democrat flared up. The independents are flared up. People who don't even vote are flared up. I'm waiting to see the next one. The next one's going to be good.
Andre Norman. Andre, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you.